hunch back, but there was no sign of them. Then, taking slower and surer measures, he began to examine the ground. It was fairly soft in patches, and, following it with care, he finally distinguished their footmarks. He saw where they had dodged behind the brush. He followed and discovered that their footmarks converged and finally came together right under the wall of the house. He examined the ground to either side most carefully. It was rock or hard gravel, but it did not seem that two hard-running men could have passed over it so recently without making a mark upon it. And yet, there was not a token on either side. At last he raised his puzzled eyes to the wall itself. What secret did it enclose? Chapter 28. He took up a good-sized stone, and with this he tapped a number of times against the wall, holding his ear close to it, in the hope that he would be able to detect a hollow sound, significant of a passage within, for it began to seem to him that the pair must, really, have disappeared through the solid masonry. However, that was a bit too fanciful to suit him. It savored a great deal too much of the Arabian Nights or fairy tales. Therefore he shook his head over the puzzle and went on back to the house. It was the second mysterious disappearance. Pausing under the window of the library, he scanned carefully the greenery of the vines that climbed up the wall, but he was unable to see any place where they had been bruised, as by hand or foot. How else could that wild girl, Francesca LaGuardia, have managed to escape from that room? He gritted his teeth over the renewed problem that was brought up by the disappearance of the two he had overheard approaching the house. Unless they were most miraculously quick of foot, into the wall they must have faded. Or else, with wonderful courage and adroitness, they had managed to slip silently into the brush and so avoid him. He was doubtful about their ability to accomplish such a feat. The brush was dry. There were plenty of twigs and fallen leaves upon the ground, and altogether that pair did not seem of the kind who would possess that craft. They had to weld in all the earmarks of common or garden city crooks, such as he had known by the gross. The rank and file, as Wilbur was used to say with his sneer. Deep in these reflections, he climbed the stairs and re-entered the library that he had left such a short time before. The doctor was there, and looked up from a newspaper with a cheerful, dim-eyed smile.
"She's sleeping, dear child," he said.
Weldon grunted. With the burden of these problems upon him, the doctor was a most unwelcome presence to him. Weldon merely nodded, and went on from the library toward his own room.
"I thought I heard a shot," Dr. Watts said with unusual calmness.
"I took a pop at a squirrel," Weldon said, and went on.
He sat down on the edge of his bed, his face between his hands, his brain whirling. In every way he had been checkmated. He had arrived at the desperate measure of having the body of the general exhumed and an autopsy performed, and the body had been stolen away the very night, as it seemed, that he was about to do the work. Then there was a good proof of this, circumstantially, in the appearance of those two rascals in the woods, they who were coming to be paid. By whom? By Francesca, of course. But that meant either that she had not left the place at all, or else that she would return to it. This deduction reduced Weldon to actual despair. If ever he had his hands upon her again, it would go very hard if she should escape from him the second time. He would keep her, and use means to wring her secrets from her. In all that he had done, he felt that he had acted as wisely as possible, except, perhaps, in revealing his suspicions to Helen O'Malley. But surely he had meant that for the best, and how could he have dreamed that she would be so sadly set on taking whatever fate offered to her? Staring moodily at the floor, his gaze finally centered on a little round spot of red, as big as a man's fingernail. Very red it was, standing out against the darker surface of the varnish. It made him so curious that he reached down, half absent-mindedly, and touched it with the tip of a finger.
When he looked again, half the spot was gone, and the fingertip was brightest crimson, blood red indeed. Weldon was startled from his dream. Blood red? Why, it was blood in very fact. And who had been dripping blood on the floor of his bedroom? He went to the library door. "Dr. Watts?"
"Well, well, well, my boy,"
said that worthy old gentleman, blinking his glasses off the bridge of his nose so that they slid halfway down to the tip of it. "You startled me. I was just reading a very interesting account of a new discovery they've made at Capua."
"Damn Capua," said the impolite Weldon. "How long have you been sitting there?"
"Only a few moments. Half an hour, perhaps."
"In fact, you stayed only a moment in her room?"
"She was sleepy. Sleep is the best medicine, you know, and I always feel that if we could learn true relaxation, true sleep, there never would be the slightest need for—"
Weldon, more impolite than ever, slammed the door in the doctor's face and went back to his study of the blood.
He went crouching here and there across the chamber, spying at every inch of the boards, and making a special scrutiny of the rugs, for one of these, to be sure, might have received a similar drop. If he could find no more than a single one, it would show much. It would show in what direction the wounded man had gone, for he had not the slightest doubt that this blood came from the wound that he had inflicted upon one of the precious pair among the pines beneath the house. At last he found what he wanted, an even larger splotch, and it lay upon the floor just opposite the room of Helen O'Malley. Exactly in front of her door it had fallen. It fairly stopped the heart of Weldon to find such a proof. But how had it come there? Had the fugitive fled into the room where the girl was lying? Had he perhaps stifled her before she could make an outcry, while the doctor sat in the library, his ears stuffed with the recent discovery at Capua? Where was Capua, anyway? He listened for an instant at the crack of the door. Then he opened it softly, and more amazed than ever, he found himself looking into the wide eyes of Helen O'Malley. She was badly frightened, apparently, though the fear in her eyes changed at once to a smile of recognition and pleasure. "Helen, have you seen something here in your room?" he asked, looking eagerly around him.
"I saw the door open stealthily just now," said the girl. "It frightened me almost to death."
"How long have you been awake?"
"Half a minute, perhaps, before that door began to open. I woke up with my heart racing. I'm so glad it was only you."
"Tell me, who did you think it might have been?"
"Well, you see, if there are people who want to get rid of me from this house, they might not wait until—"
Here she paused, and dropped her head so that the broad shadow of the hat screened her face.
"I beg your pardon," she said faintly. "I shouldn't speak of that."
The heart of Weldon was softened within him. He went to her and took her hand in his, and the coldness and the smallness of it struck a chill through him.
"You should speak to me of anything that comes into your mind," he told her. "You should speak to me of anything and of everything. I am part of you, like an extra hand, say, and you must use me. I know what you meant to say. Ah, well, if I could take you away from this place—"
"But what would you do with me?"
"I thought that I would stay behind and watch the house, but I've changed my mind. There's nothing in this house that really matters, except you. I tell you, Helen, I'd bring you to a place where no enemy could follow you. I'd sleep like a dog outside your door. I'd be living in your shadow. I'd keep you safe, and I'd find a way of pouring some of my strength into you and making you strong again also."
She looked at him with the oddest of smiles, and the most gentle, partly as if she were amused a little by this boyish enthusiasm, this boyish surety promising miracles where science had failed to help her. And partly she smiled like one already beyond this world, and passed into the dim verge of shadows. He withdrew to the doorway, and there he thought of suggesting to her that he should be allowed to search her room. But a sort of holy awe came over him, such as he had felt before when he was in her presence. He turned away, and then he went back to the library to find the doctor sitting bolt upright and shaking his beard over some article that greatly excited him. When he became aware of Weldon, he cried out, "They have it! They really have it at last!"
"They have what?" Weldon asked grimly.
"The missing arm, of course."
"Of what?"
"She wasn't holding a baby at all," Dr. Watts said, wagging his head, and at last looking up to Weldon with the broadest of grins. "She wasn't holding a baby at all. She was holding a mirror."
He laughed with great pleasure.
"It wasn't a Latona at all. Not a bit of it. I always knew that it wasn't a Latona. As a matter of fact, it was a Venus. The idiots might have known that long ago if they had paid attention to a little article that I published as long as 8 years ago in the—"
"Dr. Watts," said Weldon.
"Dear me," exclaimed the doctor. "You shock me like an electric current, half a dozen times a day. I wish that you could manage to speak to me without taking my breath away."
"I want to wake you up if I can," Weldon said.
"Ah, true, true," the doctor said. "As the years advance, I often feel a somnolence that increases in the—"
"Watts, there's blood on the floor of my bedroom."
"Good heavens," Dr. Watts replied. "I assure you I didn't put it there."
Weldon gritted his teeth. "Someone who came out of the door of her room let that blood fall in passing through mine. Do you understand?"
"Upon my soul," breathed Dr. Watts, "I don't understand at all."
"Try to, then. You heard a gun pop a little time ago?"
"Yes, yes."
"I told you I was shooting at a squirrel. I wasn't, however."
"At a bird, perhaps? There is an old crow that often perches on the—"
"This bird was a man," said Weldon. "I shot at him as he dodged, and I heard him cry out. Apparently I wounded him, perhaps in an arm as he jumped to the side. He and the man with him disappeared between the edge of the trees and the wall of the house. The eastern wall, you understand?"
"Upon my soul," cried the doctor. "Disappeared? My dear lad, there are certain laws of nature and of science that really must be—"
"Be quiet," Weldon said wearily, "and listen to what I have to say. There is a passage from the lower part of that wall to the room of Helen O'Malley, and every moment that she spends in that room, which we have been guarding so carefully, is a moment spent in the hands of her enemies. Now will you do what I want you to do?"
"I—" the doctor gasped. "I? Weldon, you overwhelm me. I simply don't—"
"You don't have to. All you have to do is what I tell you to do, and I'll make that as simple as possible. Go to Helen O'Malley and persuade her out of her room. Get her out and keep her out. I want to examine the walls and the floor of that place."
"Do you want me to use force?"
the doctor asked faintly. "Tell her that the room has a draft, that the floor is too damp. Say something, that's all I say. Do something and do it at once. We can't waste any more time."
Chapter 29 The doctor went toward the door, feeling his way from chair to chair, so overwhelmed was he by this announcement. Weldon overtook him and shook him roughly by the shoulder.
"Look here," he said. "Are you going to go into her with a face like a death mask? Brace up! Cheer yourself a little. She's had enough nerve strain today. Put it all gently. But we must get her moved out at once."
He went over by the window of the library and half-closed his eyes. He could almost have smiled now, but since he had a definite thread to follow, he swore to himself that he would follow that thread until it led to a hempen rope large enough to hang a thief and murderer. He waited for long moments, and then the doctor came in, shaking his head.
"Wait one moment," Weldon said. "I think you're going to tell me that you haven't persuaded her? If that's the case, turn on your heel and go back to her room again."
The doctor drew himself up, stiff and straight. It added actual inches to his height, and his old, filmed-over eyes gleamed with real fire.
"Young man," he said, "I like you. I even esteem you. You have strength, courage, and devotion to a good cause. But I want to remind you that there are some things in life that all the stamping and bellowing of a bull are powerless to affect. I shall not return to the room of that weary, tormented child to persuade her. She has consented to move from her room tomorrow. Isn't that enough for you?"
Weldon smiled, his teeth set hard. "And leave her another night in that danger, a door open to the world?"
What chance is there that she will be disturbed by them tonight? How many nights has she lain there without being troubled?"
There was point to this, and the doctor spoke the words so sharply that Weldon felt himself subdued a little, particularly when Henry Watts continued, "She has been under a great strain today. Who placed that strain upon her? You did, Weldon. Heaven forgive you for it. But another day like that might be the end of—" He paused, caught his breath, and said deliberately, with unspeakable emotion,
"Another day like this might be the end of Helen O'Malley. Do you want that on your head?"
And Weldon submitted, though writhing with impatience. To make the best of that bad day, he lay down on the couch in the library, and the turning of the newspaper, crinkling softly under the touch of the doctor, soothed him to sleep. When he awakened, he was astonished to find that it was late afternoon. The room was filled with dim golden light, with a flush of rose in it. Before him stood Aunt Maggie.
"You've been needin' just this sleep," she told him kindly. "Ain't you missin' your lunch?"
"Is that for me?" he asked her, pointing to a paper in her hand. She nodded, and taking the envelope, he tore it open and read, "I am in desperate need. Can you help me? F.L. "Francesca LaGuardia. In desperate need. Could he help her?" He slipped the paper into his pocket and stood up. "Who brought this?" he asked.
"Is it poison?"
she asked him, her eyes popping.
"I think it may be," he answered. "Who brought it? Or was it slipped under the door?"
He thought that much more likely, but she answered at once,
"A city man, by the look of him. He's sitting down in a right fine automobile downstairs."
In half a minute, Weldon was down the stairs also, only making sure that both his guns were loaded and in place beneath his armpits. He stepped outdoors at the rear of the house, cautiously, and there he saw beyond the patio gate a powerful-looking green roadster, and in the front seat, lolling with a cigarette, his former acquaintance, Cunningham. He went out to the man with wonder in his heart. Cunningham, seeing him, reached out a cordial hand.
"Well," he said, without preliminaries.
"Do you know what was in this letter?" Weldon asked.
"Not a word," answered Cunningham.
There are ways and ways of deceiving, and the best of all is a blunt affectation of indifference, but Weldon thought now that he was hearing golden truth indeed.
"Cunningham, if you don't know what's in the letter, how do you happen to have brought it?"
"I had a letter," Cunningham said with perfectly obvious caution. "This note was enclosed, and I was asked to deliver it to you."
"You don't often run about the country delivering notes, do you?"
"Look here," Cunningham said in the tone of one who wishes to be conciliatory, but will not be pressed too far. "I want to talk to you as a friend, Weldon. I won't be treated like a sneak thief."
"I don't mean to put it that way," Weldon said. "But I really have to find out who gave you this note for me."
"A man in whom you'd have no interest. A Mexican, in fact. Confound it, I don't know that I should have told you even this."
"Cunningham," Weldon said, "I want to believe you. But isn't it a fact that Francesca LaGuardia gave you this note?"
Cunningham opened his eyes a little.
"Francesca?"
Then he shut up and sat in his car, saying not a word. Weldon was quick to appreciate the difficulty. He brought the note from his pocket and passed it to the other.
"That's what you delivered," he pointed out.
Cunningham read it slowly, aloud.
"I am in desperate need. Can you help me?"
Then he added, lowering the paper and frowning at Weldon, "But why in heaven's name should she send to you for help?"
"I wanted to ask you that."
Cunningham bit his lip and flushed.
"I have an idea," Weldon said curiously, "that you'd as soon that she asked you."
"Nonsense," scoffed Cunningham, but the cloud remained on his brow. He seemed to be trying to puzzle out a vast problem.
"Will you tell me this?" said Weldon. "Is she in trouble? I mean, is she under the control of any person who could—"
"Under the control of the demon," Cunningham said with bitterness. "Who else could control her?" he added. "No, she's all right. She's stronger than ever, so far as I know."
"Then I think you can take back word to her that I'm engaged here."
Cunningham nodded, but he surveyed Weldon with interest.
"You really won't go?" he said.
"Certainly not."
"You're even a rarer sort than I thought," Cunningham said. "Tell me how you manage it. How can you keep away when she asks for you?"
"Because you gave me an excellent warning in the first place," replied Weldon. "Because you told me what a hellcat she is, Cunningham. I've taken her, as one might say, with a grain of salt."
"I told you about her?" Cunningham said, laughing rather bitterly. "Well, I suppose I did."
That small sentence told Weldon a great deal. The prophet who told of the fire had not been able to save himself from the flames.
"You really are not going?" Cunningham asked again.
"I've told you before. As a matter of fact, this is the crudest little trap that I've had sprung beneath my nose."
"Trap!" Cunningham cried. "Why, man, do you think she'd try to harm you after appealing to you?"
"Do you think she's above that?"
"Man, man," Cunningham muttered, like one bewildered. "Don't you know her any better than that?"
Chapter 30 By small strokes and by small touches, the portrait is finished. Now these last words of Cunningham's were like the sweep of a master, running the bold line that gives new life to the sketch, and Weldon stared at him like one who sees a ghost of glory. "I want to believe you when you say that," he warned Cunningham. "And what if you do believe me?" "I step into that car and go with you."
"Where?"
"To her." "I have no authority to take you there," said Cunningham. "You will, however." "Are you sure of that?"
"You won't be an ass, Cunningham."
"Lord knows what I am. I don't know myself. Get into this car. I'll vouch for nothing about her, except that she's not a sneak." And Weldon paused for a moment, then turned on his heel and went back to the house. He returned at once and climbed into the vacant seat.
"You'd better bring an overcoat. It gets cold at night," warned Cunningham.
Weldon did not seem to hear.
"I've done it, then," he merely murmured.
"Done what?" asked the other.
"Told them that I wouldn't be there tonight."
"Is that a great deal?" Cunningham asked, pressing the starter. The telltale hum of a straight eight answered as Weldon murmured, "I've stepped beyond my limit, I think. Heaven help me." Cunningham made no remark. He was busy in sending the car down the first rough stages of the trail, handling her with masterly efficiency, clipping the curves straighter, and burning up the open road. Then he said, "You know that, do you?"
"Know what?" Weldon asked, for his thoughts had moved far since his last speech.
"That Francesca's beyond your depth, beyond any man's depth?"
"Is she? Beyond everyone's?"
"Perhaps not," Cunningham answered. "Somewhere there is probably a skinny slip of a smart-tongued whelp who she'll begin to mother one day, and who'll get her money, and treat her like a dog, and leave her like a dog in the end." He snarled the words, then added, "She has no flaw in her armor. It's only where her heart takes her that she could be weak, if she has a heart."
"You've come to know Francesca better since I last saw you," said Weldon. "How long have you known her altogether?"
"I? How long?"
"Weeks. Centuries. I don't know. There's no time where Francesca is."
He shot the car from under the shadows of the pines. They dropped rapidly toward the desert valley, with all its waves of creosote bush and cactus now softened with the sunset rose. Then, reaching the level floor, he turned to the left.
"Is this for Francesca?" asked Weldon.
"It is," said the other, and accelerated until the exhaust hissed like a snake behind them, and the desert rose in an endless wave against their faces. However, the surface was firm. Only at sharp corners the rear wheels shot sickeningly to the side. But Cunningham, like an expert, met every swerve with the wheel and straightened the heavy car again. It was as though he were trying to run away from his thoughts, so darkened was his face.
"Know her?" he burst out suddenly. "I don't know anything about her. Why, I don't even know where she keeps her cars. Nobody knows the whole story of her. She gives you a glimpse. She gives me another. She's 20 things to 20 men, and all of them dangerous. Dangerous. You know the old riddle? Ah, but she solved it. She knows the song the sirens sing.
They drove out of the dusk into the darkness. The stars flew up like sparks behind the mountains.
"There's a shorter way," Cunningham said, half apologetically. "There's a way about a quarter the length of this, but I wanted to wait a little. It will do her good."
But presently he was settling anxiously over the wheel, his lights darting over the waving surface of the sands, his spotlight focused on the side. It was plain that he no longer drove in passion and pique, but because he was terribly anxious to reach the girl.
"Cunningham," Weldon said suddenly.
"Huh?
I don't know you very well, but I can guess that you're a little upset. You think that she might have sent to you for help. Is that it? In fact, let's be open about it. You're a bit jealous of me, old fellow."
"No more than I am of anyone else she looks at, I suppose," Cunningham said frankly.
"Have you a claim on her?"
"No more than I have on the one yonder." For that blazing star was rising like a planet in the east. They turned again to the left. It was plain that they were driving in a partial circle, and now they went up a shallow valley, with low hills on either side that sent back the song of the motor in a softer moan. Out of that valley they shot into a dark and narrow chasm that opened again a little, and before them were the lights of a small house.
"That's the place Joram has just now," Cunningham said. "She's expected there tonight."
He shut off the motor. They coasted through a fringe of tall shrubs into an opening that had been cleared of underbrush. Half a dozen cars were already there. Cunningham looked about at them with a careful eye and shifted the spotlight from one radiator hood to another.
"She's expected right enough," he said bitterly.
Then he led the way back through the shrubbery, and they came out at the side of the house. A music of twanging strings came floating through the open window, and the voice of a man singing.
"That's Loomis," Cunningham said. "Poor Jack Loomis. Wait a moment. Wait for the chorus. If she's there, why—"
The chorus came in a moment, and into the rhythm of the singing struck the voice of a girl, not very powerful, not very well trained, but rich and filled with the joy of the music, the rhythm.
"She's here," Cunningham said, "and heaven help your soul, Lou."
Weldon followed his guide to the front door and threw it down a small hall. A heap of coats were thrown on a couple of rough kitchen chairs. Hats were hung here and there or lay on the floor. Underfoot was decaying flooring. It was plain that the old shack had been recently resurrected from near ruin to serve some purpose, and no legal purpose was apt to bring the owner to this secluded bit of wilderness. Another door stood open at the end of the hall, and as they approached it, someone looked out, saw them, and advanced on them. He was big, rosy-faced, smiling, but his shifty eyes were as bright and quick as the eyes of a ferret.
"She's here, I see," said Cunningham.
"She's here. Just came 5 minutes ago."
The song ended. There was an outburst of hearty applause, and the big man turned and clapped.
"Joram, this is Weldon."
Joram acknowledged the introduction with a nod and finished his clapping before he extended his hand and shook that of Weldon heartily.
"Come in," he said. "We're short on lights, but not on drinks. What do you take?"
"Water," said Weldon.
"Ah," murmured Joram. "Working, eh? Do I know you?"
"No."
"You will," put in Cunningham, in what Weldon felt was rather a sarcastic voice. Their host led them into the next room. It was very small. On overturned boxes, on rickety chairs tied together with wire, were 7 or 8 men who Weldon surveyed with an expert eye. Take them one by one, and they never would have been noticed in a crowd, or singly. But the group had certain characteristics in mass that he did not miss. They were, above all, manly men. In the second place, they were men of experience, in several senses of that word. They ranged in years from gray-headed Joram to a blond-haired youth as pink-cheeked as an English debutante. But young or old, every one of them carried definite hallmarks. One could not have said that they were all criminals, but one could have said that every one of them was a fellow to be reckoned with by a most close account. And yonder was she, Francesca LaGuardia. She was dressed in a khaki blouse and a riding skirt, and wore riding boots that looked battered and scarred, as though they had seen much hard work through brush of the thorny kind. But the rougher her costume, the more delicately feminine appeared Francesca. He thought, when his glance first crossed hers, that she looked a little startled, a little frightened. If that were true, it was only a flash, and then she was smiling at him. Big Joram introduced him around the circle. There were curt nods, strong, quick pressures of his hand, and keen glances that searched him through and through. The heart of Weldon grew lighter. On him, like a great dark burden, lay the knowledge that he was leaving Helen O'Malley unguarded in the house on the hill. It might well be that Francesca had drawn him away for the very purpose of rendering the other girl helpless. And yet he began to forget these doubts and fears. With such men as these, he felt as though he could tear down mountains. And after all, his hands had been empty of employment for many days. Only his wits had had to work. She would not want him for that. Not Francesca. She had her own subtle brain to work with. She wanted the weight of his hand. In that circle of introductions he came to her. She did not sparkle or laugh with pleasure. She merely took his hand and looked long and gravely into his eyes. Chapter 31 Joram came up to them.
"Is this your man, Francesca?" he asked her.
"I want to talk to him for 2 minutes," she said. "Where can we go?"
"Here," Joram showed them into an adjoining room. It had not been furnished. There was a dusty dirt floor, a broken chair lay on its side in a corner, and the moonlight streamed pale and steady through the window, where a shutter hung by one hinge. Francesca went to the window. Weldon stood before her. They remained quiet for an instant, she studying his face, and he bracing himself.
"I hoped," she said suddenly. "I didn't think you'd come. What made you feel that it wasn't a trap?"
"Cunningham." She shook her head.
"Not Cunningham," she said.
"No, not entirely." She neither flushed nor smiled at the implication. She was as steady as a rock, and he felt almost as hard.
"I told you that I was desperate," she said, "because I have a thing to do that requires help that only you can give me. I have to cross the river and bring back with me a man who's closely guarded by people I have to get him away from."
He gestured toward the door. "You have plenty of men in there," he said. "And, mind you, I'm not a genius at driving a car or using a rifle."
"I know you're not," she replied. "There are men in there who could shoot out the whites of your eyes, I suppose. At least, with rifles. But if there's any shooting to be done, and there will be, it will be with revolvers."
She waited again to see how he would take this, and he responded with perfect silence. If there was need for revolvers, it meant desperate hand-to-hand work of some sort.
"I'll tell you exactly what it is," she went on. "Then you can withdraw and simply say that you're not interested, or else..."
She hesitated, and as she paused a smile quivered on her lips, very much as though she said in silence to herself, "If he accomplishes this thing for me, he will be one man in the world." And the heart of Weldon beat faster than ever.
"His name is Jim Dickinson. Did you ever hear of him?"
"Yes, somewhere. I don't know. I have the name in my mind."
"Of course you have. Everyone's heard of him at some time. Jim Dickinson is held across the river in San Trinidad by Miguel Cabrero. Cabrero is holding him for a ransom so high that it can't be paid."
"Holding him in the gambling house?"
"No, in his cafe. Letting him have a perfectly free life. But every minute of the day and night, he's surrounded by half a dozen fighting Mexicans. Do you know Mexicans?"
"I do."
"And you know they can be fighters?"
"I know that."
"But sometimes they need leading?"
"Yes, that's true."
"He has a white man to lead them. The name of that man is Benjamin Wilbur."
Dr. Wilbur?
You see why I had to have you, she said simply.
She had laid the facts before him in a straight line. Nothing could have been simpler than her declaration, and he was aware that it must have been the truth, or very close to the truth. She continued,
Every evening they sit late in front of the cafe and drink beer and smoke cigarettes and watch Jim Dickinson. We have to go there and try to get him away. A desperate undertaking, you'll admit.
You must give me time to get in touch with Wilbur. I might be able to influence him.
Of course you could, but there's no time.
Must it be done tonight?
It must. The Mexican police want Jim Dickinson. Every police force in the world wants him, I suppose.
She smiled a little as she said it. And they know where he is now?
They begin to suspect. It was very clever of Cabrera to keep Dickinson so openly. That fooled the Mexican police, like hiding a hat on a hat rack. But now they're on the trail of Jim. They'll have him before morning, probably. That leaves us tonight, and we have to work.
You leave one thing out of the count. Cabrera and Cabrero's men know me, and they would be after me like foxes after a goose.
Of course they would. But they won't have a chance to recognize you after Joram is done with you.
Unless you begin to sing. Eyes like the evening, throat like the dawn. And she smiled again. He recapitulated carefully. We ought to go to San Trinidad to the cafe. There I'm to try to speak a word to Wilbur in a disguise and try to bring him over to our side. After that, he and you and I are to try to handle 6 fighting Mexicans and get this unarmed Dickinson away from them.
Not the 6 only, she said frankly. One yell from them, and the whole street will rise up against us.
He half-closed his eyes, thinking hard. Dickinson pays high for this, I suppose, he said.
And you want to know what your share would be, of course? She asked.
I don't do this for money, Weldon said. But she would not aid him. He had to say, I don't think that you're doing this for money either. Her eyes flashed to one side and then to the other. He could tell that a lie was forming in her throat, but then she gave her head a little shake.
I'm not doing this for money, she admitted.
He set his teeth and drew a breath, thinking, Not money, love. But it is always true of these women of the Francesca type. 1,000 men could become fools about them in their beauty. They, in turn, were sure to be weak-minded about one man, and usually a worthless one. He could not help adding, Dickinson, will he be a help?
Jim Dickinson is a tiger, she answered. He's as strong as you are, I suppose, and he'll be fighting for his life as soon as we can throw him a weapon.
Not so worthless, then, after all. And she had chosen a man, even if he were a criminal. It was a grim satisfaction to Weldon. And yet he could have laughed aloud at the irony of this trap in which he was caught. He, with all his strength, at the peril of his life, was to rescue the lover of Francesca and give him back safely to her. He was to do it not for money, but for love of the girl. And she knew it was love of her that forced him on. How had she been able to tell? Certainly not by any gentleness in his treatment of her at the O'Malley house, but brazenly, fiercely, she intended to use him. Scorn of her rose hot in his heart, scorn of himself to be the Samson to such a Delilah. I suppose I'll go, he said. And then he saw a sudden relaxation in her. Her lips parted in a sigh of relief. Surely she never had doubted from the first that he would do what she wanted, or else she would never have sent for him. Relief, then, because of what? Because this interview was ended. Even Francesca LaGuardia, in the deeps of her soul, possessed some vanishing relics of shame, it appeared, and Weldon smiled to himself again. Something in him was turning to iron, and he knew that if he fought this night, he would fight to kill.
"So Joram can start on you?" asked Francesca.
"Yes, as soon as you please."
"We're late already," she said. "We're horribly late."
He followed her to the door of the room.
but she turned back to him to say, "I'll send Joram to you here. He'll have everything."
"Very well."
Still she lingered, and stepping closer to him, she touched his hand. "Everything that you think is wrong," Francesca said. And she vanished through the doorway.
Chapter 32. He sat on the windowsill and waited. The moon glittered in the tops of the young poplars. The ground was dappled with shadows that stirred slightly to and fro, like the shifting footfalls of unseen dancers, and a thousand things rushed through the brain of Weldon. All his thoughts were wrong, she had told him. All of what thoughts? That she was saving Jim Dickinson because she loved him? What other solution, indeed, could there be? Had she spoken the truth, or merely told him a lie at the last moment, for the sake of enlisting him more completely in the cause of this night's adventure? Leaving the window, he walked gloomily back and forth. Joram did not come. That troubled him not a little. At the last moment, of course, they might decide that it was better to get rid of Weldon than to use him, and he told himself that nothing was beneath Francesca. Perhaps nothing was above her, either. At last the door opened. A big man stood on the threshold, carrying a bundle of clothes over his arm and a lantern in his hand. That lantern light flared up on a brown face glistening with moisture, on beetling black brows, and a short mustache, hardly thicker than the mustache of a Chinaman.
"The time's come for you," Joram announced, speaking from the throat of this apparent Mexican. "And if I can't make as good a job of you as I can of myself, still, I'll pass you at night in a crowd."
He set to work at once. Weldon had to throw off his clothes, and then he was liberally stained with walnut juice to a nut-brown color. Some red was worked into his cheeks, his eyebrows made black as jet, and over his head was pulled a rough wig, of which the hair seemed as stiff as bristles, standing up wildly, or falling low down over his eyes. All that was rough and brutal in the face of Weldon was now apparent, and Joram chuckled as he stood back and looked at his victim.
"They'll jump 10 feet to give you room, Weldon," he said. "You look like a yaki, and they give those fellows passageway every time, you can be sure."
The clothes to complete the disguise consisted of a wide-brimmed sombrero of ragged straw, a battered, time-stained coat, and trousers that had once been white and now were gray, or worse. They were in such tatters below the knees that they had to be furled. As for shoes, there were rude sandals bound tightly to the foot, with thongs that wound around and around the leg, and tied again above the calf. As if this were not enough, the shirt he was given was of flaming red silk, also so worn that the skin peeped through it.
"Can you play any instrument?" asked Joram.
"The guitar a little."
"No good?"
"I'm fair at it. Pretty good, in fact."
"Let's hear you."
He left the room and returned at once with a perfectly tuned guitar. Weldon seized it, laughed aloud, and from his throat burst a tremendous baritone voice that rang and shook through the room.
"Eyes like the evening, throat like the dawn." "Good," Joram said, stuffing his fingers into his ears. "Don't deafen me. That will do very well. We'll have to start. Have you your guns?"
"I have to arrange those."
They were arranged, oddly enough, in cleverly devised holsters, the straps of which fitted about the shoulders, and the revolvers were suspended beneath the pits of the arms. They were spring holsters, and the weapons came away at a sweep of the hands, which could reach up easily under the loose coat. Joram eyed this contrivance with much interest.
"But does it work?" he asked. "Can you get out a Colt that way?"
"It works fairly well," Weldon said. And to prove his point, he conjured a weapon out of the naked air and made it vanish again, smiling.
The other blinked.
"Wonderful," he said. "I'll be coming to your school one of these days."
He led the way out of the house. They found Cunningham standing mournfully beside the long gray car.
I thought so, he said as he saw the pair approach. And I'm left out of the party?
She'll kindly accept your head another night, Joram said. But I'm not sure of the entire plan. Perhaps she'll take it now.
He had hardly ended his speech when a strange young barbarian came through the night. Around her head was twisted a red scarf of silk that floated down her back. In her ears were big green glass earrings. Around her throat was a gilded necklace of great beads. She wore a short jacket, set off with a border of flashing gilt braid, and her short skirt flared like that of a ballet dancer. Her footgear was like that of Weldon, the thongs lashed over the calf of the bare brown leg. To give an impossible touch of modesty, she carried, however, a long web of black lawn as a mantilla. And yet in this dark-skinned, shameless creature, Weldon was sure of Francesca LaGuarda. She laughed at him beneath the moon.
"See the signor," she said to Cunningham. "Muy diablo, no?"
Cunningham answered gravely, "I ought to be in this party, Francesca. I've been in school long enough, and you ought to let me go with you."
"Of course you're coming," Francesca said pleasantly. "We couldn't get on without you. You have one of the most important parts. Get in. Joram, you drive. I'll save myself for the return trip."
Taking for granted, apparently, that she was the premier chauffeur of the party, she waved Cunningham into the front seat beside Joram.
"I have to sit behind with Lou," she said cheerfully. "Throw me a blanket. I don't want to freeze."
She sprang into the automobile, and when Weldon climbed in, she wrapped herself in the blanket that Cunningham passed to her and curled up on the seat, her feet tucked skillfully beneath her, her head against Weldon's shoulder. Cunningham surveyed this scene from the front seat. "If you're going to play baby doll," he said with disgust, "I'll stay home."
"Keep your eyes on the road and help the driver," said Francesca. "I'm lonely and need comforting."
"You're a wildcat in the wilderness," Cunningham said in half-serious retort, "and you'll have all our throats cut before morning. Go on, Joram, and while you drive, tell me what this is all about."
Weldon, stiff and uncomfortable, looked down at the head against his shoulder. The car moved, grated in first, hummed in second, and then went into top speed with a hiss of sand beneath the spinning wheels and a mutter of the exhaust. They shot through the brush and tore up a slight incline. It did not seem a road, but the sand was level and compacted. They flew up the slope and ducked at the top into a long, easy ravine. With the lurch of the turning, Francesca tipped far to the side.
"You'll have to hold me in," she said in the ear of Weldon.
He laughed and put his arm around her. "This is a very old song for such an artist as you, Francesca," he said. "I suppose they've all held you like this and looked in your eyes."
"Who?"
she asked, watching him and stirring to make herself comfortable. "A lot of them." And with a jerk of his head, he indicated the men who were behind in the shack of Joram.
"Nobody in the world," said Francesca.
The car leaped down a sharp incline with a speed that took the breath of Weldon. She explained slowly,
"Roger's a silly fellow. He doesn't understand."
"He's rather sad about you, Francesca."
"This month, yes, but he never has more than a 30-day fever. I don't want to talk about him."
"What is this for?" he asked her.
She looked ahead of her for a moment. Already they were leaving the hills. Two long, sloping arms of silver retired on either side, and the pungent scent of the desert was in their nostrils. The sand purred against the mudguards.
"Well," she said, "what do you think?"
"Because you feel that I'm not quite safe," said Weldon. "A little more devoted to you, and I'll fight a little harder. So I'm to sit here and grow foolish under the moon. Isn't that it?"
She let her head fall back on his shoulder. It was not coquetry. Angry as he was, and more than half scornful, he could tell that. The car, reeling along the road at great speed, made her head sway a little from side to side.
"We may all be dead in another hour or two," she commented.
Have you thought of that?
No.
Does it make no difference to you?
Asked Francesca. None whatever.
Do you mean that?
He said gravely, I've been a good deal of a scoundrel in my time, Francesca. I've taken life as I found it, and one finds it in need of a good deal of sifting as a rule. That made no difference to me. But recently, I found a chance to do one good thing. No money in it, no reward of any kind, except a sort of satisfaction and a duty done. Well, you sent for me, and I gave up that work tonight.
That's the girl on the hill. That's Helen, she said.
He was silent.
But do you really think she is such an angel? Francesca asked. Is she so pure and perfect?
We'd better talk of something else, said Weldon.
You can be a snob, I see, Francesca observed. Well, most men can be. But I'm glad to talk of something else. Only I want you to know what I meant when I said that we may all be dead before the morning.
And suppose we live through it.
Ah, then we can be happy forever.
Running guns and Chinamen across the border?
Doing whatever you want. From clerking in a store to wrecking trains, I don't care, she said.
He laughed ironically. You'd come with me, then? He said. Do I understand that that is what you mean?
Yes. Don't be sarcastic and hard-minded. I'm talking like one about to die.
He looked away from her, trying to think logically, with a straight mind. The moon was well up. The thin desert foliage swept past them like silver mist and low cloud on cloud. And his thoughts tangled and fell into confusion. He began to be aware of the racing of his heart, fast as the racing of the motor, it seemed. Cunningham looked back at them, shrugged his shoulders, and then resolutely squared himself to watch the road.
He thinks that I'm talking to you like a chorus girl, said Francesca.
And what are you saying instead, Francesca?
I'm trying to make you understand that for more than a year I've schemed and worked and prayed and fought for tonight. If I win, I can't tell you what, but if I win, there's happiness before us. And if I die?
He waited, and then suggested more gently, And if you die, Francesca?
Then, before the end, I want you to know that I loved you.
He stared at her, sick with unbelief. Tell me the cold, naked truth, he begged. I'd like it better than this bare-faced lying.
Are you sure of that? She asked him.
She settled herself a little closer to him, looking up with the wide, empty eyes of a child. I'm sure of that, of course.
Will you tell me why?
Then instead of going on this foolish chase across the river to find a criminal named Dickinson, we'd leave all these people and...
And then?
Go up to the house on the hill and take care of poor Helen O'Malley until she dies. She said patiently,
You spoke of duty. I want you to know that it's duty that takes me over the river tonight. I can't turn back, even for you. And if you knew why, you wouldn't wonder at me. You'd simply take it for granted and believe me utterly.
Believe that you care for me?
Believe that I love you. I love you,
Francesca whispered.
He, all ice with cold wonder, looked before him and tried to see the truth, and then he glanced down at her.
She was still waiting for the answer. And then belief grew up in him and unfolded like a strange flower, poisoned with the very unbelief from which it had come, and all the more beautiful because of it.
I do believe, Weldon said.
Now, if it was a cunning lie she had acted, what would she do? What would she say? She merely closed her eyes.
You've made it terribly hard work for me, she said. Hold me safe. I want to sleep.
Chapter 33 And sleep she did, while the desert flew behind them, and the lights of the towns grew brighter to the left, and the black brow of Bull Mountain rose to the right. At last the face of the water was before them.
They turned straight down the bank, and the jolting jerked the head of the girl far forward. Carefully, he made her comfortable. She opened her eyes and smiled sleepily. An instant later, she was slumbering again. Then he saw that there was a flat-decked barge before them, with a man standing on either side of it. The front tires pressed upon a gangway that ground against the pebbles underneath. Then the deck jarred hollow as they lurched out on it. The brakes groaned. The car was still. At once the two boatmen loosed the barge. A motor began to cough, sending its voice far off through the night, and they headed well up into the current. Still Francesca slept, and Joram turned and regarded her gravely, changed his studious glance to Weldon, and then touched the shoulder of Cunningham.
"Is it real?" he asked, making little effort to keep his voice low.
"When conversation is hard, it's the easiest way, isn't it?" Cunningham said with contempt. Perhaps he was very right. Certainly there was much in the heart of Weldon that said that it was sheerest acting. All except the sleep. That was real enough. And as for the rest, well, a great actress may command her audience, of course. Besides, there was a certain sting in the voice of Cunningham, as if he disbelieved his own words. They met the center of the current, the force of it sending them downstream. The motor increased its beat, and as though released from a strong hand, they swept in suddenly toward the farther shore.
"No border patrol, thank goodness," Joram said. "You can't buy off those fellows."
The motor was shut off. The barge grounded. The two boatmen, who had not spoken, now ran the gangway on shore, and the heavy car trundled cautiously off. With the rear wheels still on the boards, Joram turned in the driver's seat.
"Can you buck up against the current?" he asked.
"If we can keep in the shallows and not run aground."
"If you ground her," Joram said savagely, "I'll make the rest of your lives short and hot. You hear?"
There was a sullen muttering, and Joram continued,
"Get her up there above the bend, and run her in under the branches of those willows. Stick some other branches along her side and the stern. We've got to take no chances. Make her look like a part of the shore. Remember, boys, there's a cold thousand if we get back across."
"Loaded or empty?"
asked one of the boatmen in a sharply nasal voice.
"Loaded or empty," Joram agreed. "I'm talking about the car, not about what's in it."
"I'll do my bit," the bargekeeper said. "Only I want you to know that they're looking sharp lately. They've got two launches that cut the water like a pair of fish. Machine guns, too."
"The border patrol," Joram said, swearing beneath his breath. "They're too alive here. We'll have to shift headquarters. Hang hard onto the job tonight, Jerry. That's all. And so long."
"So long," Jerry said.
He waved a long arm, the car rumbled off the gangplank, and went up the bank with a snort of effort, like a lunging horse. Part of the bank crumpled. Still the big tires caught hold and shoved the weight upward until the level of the plain was before them. Francesca sat erect.
"I'll take the wheel," she said. "I know the lay of this land."
Joram changed places with her, and she drove the car steadily ahead, swinging in and out through the mesquite and past the reaching, low-spread arms of creosote bushes.
"Watch her," Joram said. "Beauty, ain't she? Makes the car work out like a good pointer. Not a whisper out of it."
Silently, indeed, they stole forward, circling slightly with the town to the left, until they were well in the rear of San Trinidad. Then she brought it to a stop and blew the hand horn twice, long, soft notes. They waited. No one spoke. A hoot owl sounded in the distance, a long and mournful cry, and then shadows appeared in the brush. They developed into what seemed a ragged peon leading three mules. They bore on their backs high Mexican saddles, with the leather peeling from the pommels. Behind the saddles appeared small packs.
"It's Joe," Francesca said, springing down from the car. "Joe, have you been working them?"
"I've given them 20 miles across country," Joe answered. "They're hot enough and dusty enough to look as if they've been traveling."
"Where did you get them?"
"Here and there."
You bought them, of course.
Pay when you have to, take when you can, Joe said with the air of a philosopher. Why should you pay for things that you can pick up anywhere?